Madam Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, and they have all taken their places now, and the Joint Committee will escort the President into the chamber in just a moment. Colonel Starling, the Chief of the White House Secret Service, has been going up and down the corridor which runs off this House library, and we can anticipate that the President will be here very shortly. This is the 25th time that Congress has had a special session since its organization 150 years ago. John Adams was the first president to call a special session. He summoned the 5th Congress to meet on May 15th in 1797 to consider suspension of diplomatic relations with France. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison each found it necessary to call two extraordinary sessions, and Mr. Lincoln called another just before the Civil War. The greatest number of special sessions have been summoned by Woodrow Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt, three each. Mr. Roosevelt's first extraordinary session of Congress was in March of 1933 to pass emergency New Deal laws. The second was in October of 1937 to enact the Social, Labor, and Farm legislation, and this special session that has convened today makes the third. Right now, the members of the House and the Senate are all sitting quietly in their seats. The galleries, as to be expected, are filled to overflowing, and standees are standing at all of the doors. The presidential box is directly opposite us across the full length of the House, and it's very hard to recognize anybody sitting in the box from here, but we can see some of the presidential confidential secretaries, Miss Grace Tully, and I believe Miss LeHand is up there too. Outside of that, all of the boxes, right up to the very edge of the standing room, are filled to overflowing, and although the scene is not as bright as it was on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of the Congress last spring, the color is still there. There are many ladies in the audience, and they're all dressed in bright new autumn clothes. Colonel Starling, the Chief of the White House Secret Service, has just come in the door immediately to the right of the rostrum and has spoken to some of the members of the Secret Service standing there, so we can expect now that the President will be here shortly. An hour before the scheduled convocation of Congress this morning and 3 hours before President Roosevelt's speech, vantage points up here in the galleries of the House where the joint session is to be held were taken over by newsreels and still cameramen. Even then, a few spectators with the coveted passes that entitle them to seats arrived. That was at 11 o'clock this morning. At that time, your reporter was here, and there were only two members on the floor itself, and they were Representatives Curtis and Graham. Both, incidentally, are among the few who have established perfect attendance records at the last session. Microphones were put in their places, and automobile parking in the plaza in front of the Capitol was banned. 2 hours ago, also, large crowds of spectators began to trek across the lawns and take up vantage points near the entrance to the House so that they might see the President as he arrived. Over on the Senate side, your reporter was there this morning, too, before this Congress was convened to hear the President's address. Vice President Garner was at his office very early, we were told, and was talking about his pecan crop and the bantam chickens in Uvalde, Texas, where he lives. A few senators, including Senator McCarran of Nevada, meticulously attired in a cutaway, strolled about the chamber. And the Senate gallery, strangely, were crowded, although the Senate's only task was to march to the House chamber to hear the President's message. Page boys, who had had their vacations interrupted by the special session, were making very sure that the senator's inkwells were filled and the pen points and pens and such things were in place for a busy week, or perhaps the busy weeks which are to follow. Now the House is sitting there in order, waiting for the President to come in, and we've just received a signal that the President has started down the corridor, which leads directly into the House itself. And we can expect Mr. Roosevelt to come through the door leading to the Speaker's platform in just a moment. At that time, of course, the whole House will rise, and undoubtedly we will hear an ovation for Mr. Roosevelt. There always is one when he comes into this House to speak before the two sessions of Congress. Speaker Bankhead and Vice President Garner are presiding jointly, of course, over this joint session. As I told you, they are sitting together up where the Speaker normally sits alone. That is a marble dais which is in back of the Speaker's rostrum in itself, where President Roosevelt will make his speech. Up overhead, the sun is shining brightly through the glassed-in window, and we can see the famed coffin that is the speaker for the House amplifying system. And now Colonel Starling is coming through the side entrance to the House of Representatives, and President Roosevelt can be seen through the door going down the corridor with Secretary Early. Mr. Bankhead has just announced the President of the United States, and here's the ovation for the President. You can hear the ovation. Colonel Starling has just gone up and tested the speaker's platform to be sure that it was sturdily built. And President Roosevelt, with the two committees, one from the House and one from the Senate, is walking slowly up the ramp. Now you can hear the shouts and the roar of the crowd as President Roosevelt starts to walk up towards the speaker's platform on the arm of Brigadier General Watson, his secretary. Behind him is his bodyguard, Tom Qualters, and the two committees now are being conducted off the speaker's dais and back to their seats. Vice President Garner has shaken hands with some of the members of the committee, and both the Vice President and Mr. Bankhead are smiling and saying a few words to Mr. Roosevelt as he walks toward the speaker's platform. The ovation continues for the President as he stands there and now lifts his splendid head to smile at the crowd in his usual manner. He stands there quietly for a moment, and in just a minute now, President Roosevelt will begin his speech. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, I have asked the Congress to reassemble in extraordinary session in order that it may consider and act on the amendment of certain legislation, which in my best judgment so alters the historic foreign policy of the United States that it impairs the peaceful relations of the United States with foreign nations. At the outset, I proceed on the assumption that every member of the Senate and of the House of Representatives and every member of the executive branch of the government, including the President and his associates, personally and officially, are equally and without reservation in favor of such measures as will protect the neutrality, the safety, and the integrity of our country, and at the same time, keep us out of war. Because I am fully willing to ascribe an honorable desire for peace to those who hold different views from my own as to what those measures should be, I trust that these gentlemen will be sufficiently generous to ascribe equally lofty purposes to those with whom they disagree. Let no man or group in any walk of life assume exclusive protectorate over the future well-being of America, because I conceive that regardless of party or section, the mantle of peace, the mantle of patriotism, is wide enough to cover us all. Let no group assume the exclusive label of the peace bloc. We all belong to it. I have at all times kept the Congress and the American people informed of events and trends in foreign affairs. I now review them in a spirit of understatement. Since 1931, the use of force instead of the council table has constantly increased in disputes between nations, except in the Western Hemisphere, where in all those years there has been only one war, now happily terminated. During those years also, the building up of vast armies and navies and storehouses of war has proceeded abroad with growing speed and intensity. But during these years, and extending back even to the days of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the United States has constantly, consistently, and conscientiously done all in its power to encourage peaceful settlements, to bring about reduction of armaments, and to avert threatened wars. We have done this not only because any war anywhere necessarily hurts American security and American prosperity, but because of the more important fact that any war anywhere retards the progress of morality and religion and impairs the security of civilization itself. For many years, the primary purpose of our foreign policy has been that this nation and this government should strive to the utmost to aid in avoiding war among nations. But if and when war unhappily comes, the government and the nation must exert every possible effort to avoid being drawn in to the war. The executive branch of the government did its utmost within our traditional policy of non-involvement to aid in averting the present appalling war. Having thus striven and failed, this government must lose no time or effort to keep our nation from being drawn in. In my candid judgment, we shall succeed in those efforts. We are proud of the historical record of the United States and of all the Americas during all these years because we have thrown every ounce of our influence for peace into the scale of peace. I note in passing what you will all remember, the long debates of the past on the subject of what constitutes aggression, on the methods of determining who the aggressor might be, and on who the aggressor in past wars had been. Academically, this may have been instructive, as it may have been of interest to historians to discuss the pros and the cons and the rights of the wrong and wrongs of the World War during the decade that followed it. But in the light of problems of today, problems of tomorrow, responsibility for acts of aggression is not conceived, and the writing of the record can safely be left to future historians. There has been sufficient realism in the United States to see how close to our own shores came dangerous paths which were being followed on other continents. Last January, I told the Congress that a war which threatened to envelop the world in flames has been averted, but it has become increasingly clear that peace is not assured. By April last, new tensions had developed. A new crisis was in the making. Several nations with whom we had had friendly, diplomatic, and commercial relations had lost or were in the process of losing their independent identity and their very sovereignty. During the spring and summer, the trend was definitely toward further acts of military conquest and away from peace. As late as the end of July, I spoke to members of the Congress about the definite possibility of war. I should have called it the probability of war. And last January also, I spoke to this Congress of the need for further warning of new threats of conquest, military and economic, a challenge to religion, to democracy, and to international good faith. I said an ordering of society which relegates religion, democracy, and good faith among nations to the background can find no place within it for the ideals of the Prince of Peace. The United States rejects such an ordering and retains its ancient faith. And I said, we know what might happen to us of the United States if the philosophies of force were to encompass the other continents and invade our own. We, no more than other nations, can afford to be surrounded by the enemies of our faith and our humanity. Fortunate it is, therefore, that in this Western Hemisphere, we have under a common ideal of democratic government a rich diversity of resources and of peoples functioning together in mutual respect and peace. And last January, in the same message, I also said, we have learned that when we deliberately try to legislate neutrality, our neutrality laws may operate unevenly and unfairly, may actually give aid to an aggressor and deny it to the victim. The instinct of self-preservation should warn us that we ought not to let that happen anymore. And it was because of what I foresaw last January from watching the trend of foreign affairs and their probable effect upon us that I recommended to the Congress in July of this year that changes be enacted in our neutrality law. The essentials for American peace in this war-torn world, have not changed since last January or last July. And that is why I ask you again to re-examine our own legislation. Go back a little. Beginning with the foundation of our constitutional government in the year 1789, the American policy in respect to belligerent nations, with one notable exception, was based on international law. Be it remembered that what we call international law has always had as its primary objectives the avoidance of causes of war and the prevention of the extension of war. The single exception to which I refer was the policy adopted by this nation during the Napoleonic Wars, when, seeking to avoid involvement, we acted for some years under the so-called Embargo and Non-Intercourse Acts. That policy turned out to be a disastrous failure. First, because it brought our own nation close to ruin, and second, because it was the major cause of bringing us into active participation in European wars in our own War of 1812. And it is merely reciting history to recall to you that one of the results of the policy of embargo and non-intercourse was the burning in 1814 a part of this capital in which we are assembled today. Our next deviation, by statute, from the sound principles of neutrality and peace through international law did not come for 130 years. It was the so-called Neutrality Act of 1935, only 4 years ago, an act continued in force by the joint resolution of May 1st, 1937. Despite grave doubts expressed as to its wisdom by many senators and representatives, and by officials charged with the conduct of our foreign relations, including myself. I regret that the Congress passed that act. I regret equally that I signed that act. On July 14th of this year, I asked the Congress in the cause of peace and in the interest of real American neutrality and security to take action to change that act. I now ask again that such action be taken in respect to that part of the act which is wholly inconsistent with ancient precepts of the laws of nations, the embargo provisions. I ask it because they are, in my opinion, most vitally dangerous to American neutrality, American security, and above all, American peace. These embargo provisions, as they exist today, prevent the sale to a belligerent by an American factory, the sale of any completed implements of war. But they allow the sale of many types of uncompleted implements of war, as well as all kinds of general material and supplies. They furthermore allow such products of industry and agriculture to be taken in American flag ships to belligerent nations. There in itself, under the present law, lies definite danger to our neutrality and our peace. From a purely material point of view, what is the advantage to us in sending all manner of articles across the ocean for final processing? Final processing there, when we could give employment to thousands by doing it here. Incidentally, and again, from the material point of view, by such employment here, we automatically aid in building up our own national defense. And if abnormal profits appear in our midst, even in time of peace, as a result of such an increase of our industries, I feel certain that the subject will be adequately dealt with at the coming regular session of the Congress. Let me set forth the present paradox of the existing legislation in its simplest terms. If prior to 1935 a general war had broken out in Europe, the United States would have sold to and bought from belligerent nations such goods and products of all kinds as the belligerent nations, with their existing facilities and geographical situations, were able to buy from us or sell to us. This would have been the normal practice under the age-old doctrines of international law. Our prior position accepted the facts of geography, the facts of conditions of land power and sea power and air power alike, as they existed in all parts of the world. If a war had broken out in Europe in 1935, there would have been no difference, for example, between our exports of sheets of aluminum and airplane wings. Today, there is an artificial legal difference. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the export of cotton and the export of gun cotton. Today, there is. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the shipment of brass tubing in pipe form and brass tubing in shell form. Today, there is. Before 1935, there would have been no difference between the export of a motor truck and an armored motor truck. today there is. Let us be factual. Let us recognize that a belligerent nation often needs wheat and lard and cotton for the survival of its population just as much as it needs anti-aircraft guns and anti-submarine depth charges. Let those who seek to retain the present embargo position be wholly consistent. Let them seek new legislation to cut off cotton and copper and meat and wheat and 1,000 other articles from all of the nations at war. Yet I seek a greater consistency. A greater consistency through the repeal of the embargo provisions and a return to international law. I seek reenactment of the historic and traditional American policy, which, except for the disastrous interlude of the embargo and non-intercourse laws, more than a century and a quarter ago, has served us well from the very beginning of our constitutional existence. It has been erroneously said that return to that policy might bring us nearer war. I give to you my deep and unalterable conviction, based on years of experience as a worker in the field of international peace, that by the repeal of the embargo, the United States will more probably remain at peace than if the law remains as it stands today. I say this because with the repeal of the embargo, this government clearly and definitely will insist that American citizens and American ships keep away from the immediate perils of the actual zones of conflict. And so, I think that repeal of the embargo and a return to international law are the crux of the issue that faces it. The enactment of the embargo provisions did more than merely reverse our traditional policy. It had the effect of putting land powers on the same footing as naval powers, so far as seaborne commerce was concerned. A land power which threatened war could thus feel assured in advance that any prospective sea power antagonist would be weakened through denial of its ancient right to buy anything anywhere. This, 4 years ago, began to give a definite advantage to one belligerent as against another, not through his own strength or geographical position, but through an affirmative act on the part of the United States. Removal of the embargo is merely reverting to the sounder international practice and pursuing in time of war, as in time of peace, our ordinary trade policies. This will be liked by some and disliked by others, depending on the view they take of the present war. But that is not the issue. The step I recommend is to put this country back on a solid footing of real and traditional neutrality. When and if, I don't like even to mention the word if, I'd rather say when the repeal of the embargo is accomplished, certain other phases of policy reinforcing American safety should be considered. And while nearly all of us are in agreement on their objectives, the only question relates to method. I believe that American merchant vessels should as far as possible be restricted from entering war zones. But war zones may change so swiftly and so frequently in the days to come that it is impossible to fix them permanently by act of Congress. Specific legislation may prevent adjustment to constant and quick change, and it seems therefore more practical to delimit the actual geography of these war zones through action of the State Department and administrative agencies. The objective of restricting American ships from entering such zones may be attained by prohibiting such entry by the Congress, or the result can be substantially achieved by executive proclamation that all such voyages are solely at the risk of the American owners themselves. The second objective is to prevent American citizens from traveling on belligerent vessels or traveling in danger areas. This can be accomplished also either by legislation, through continuance in force of certain provisions of existing law, or by proclamation making it clear to all Americans that any such travel is at their own risk. The third objective, requiring the foreign buyer to take transfer of title in this country to commodities purchased by belligerents, is also a result that can be attained by legislation or substantially achieved through due notice by proclamation. The fourth objective is the preventing of war credits to belligerents. This can be accomplished by maintaining in force existing provisions of law or by proclamation making it clear that if credits are granted by American citizens to belligerents, our government will take no steps in the future to relieve them of risk or loss. The result of these last two objectives will be to require all purchases to be made in cash and cargoes to be carried in the purchaser's own ships at the purchaser's own risk. Two other objectives have been amply attained by existing law, namely regulating collection of funds in this country for belligerents and the maintenance of a license system covering import and export of arms, ammunition, and implements of war. Under present enactments, such arms cannot be carried to belligerent countries on American vessels, and this provision should not be disturbed. The Congress, of course, should make its own choice of the method by which these safeguards are to be attained, so long as the method chosen will meet the needs of new and changing day-to-day situations and dangers. To those who say that this program would involve a step toward war on our part, I reply that it offers far greater safeguards than we now possess or have ever possessed to protect American lives and property from danger. It is a positive program for giving safety. This means less likelihood of incidents and controversies which tend to draw us into conflict, as they unhappily did before the last World War. There lies the road to peace. The position of the executive branch of the government is that the age-old and time-honored doctrine of international law, coupled with these positive safeguards, is better calculated than any other means to keep us out of war. in respect to our own defense. You are aware that I have issued a proclamation setting forth a national emergency in connection with the observance, safeguarding, and enforcement of neutrality and the strengthening of the national defense within the limits of peacetime authorizations. This was done solely to make wholly constitutional and legal certain obviously necessary measures. I have authorized increases in the personnel of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard. Increases which will bring all four of them to a total still below peacetime strength as authorized by the Congress. I have authorized the State Department to use for the repatriation of Americans caught in the war zone the sum of $500,000 already authorized by the Congress. I have authorized the addition of 150 persons to the Department of Justice to be used in the protection of the United States against subversive foreign activities within our border. At this time, I ask for no further authority from the Congress. At this time, I see no need for further executive action under the proclamation of limited national emergency. Therefore, I see no impelling reason for the consideration of other legislation at this extraordinary session of the Congress. It is, of course, possible that in the months to come, unforeseen needs for further legislation may develop. But they are not imperative today. These perilous days demand cooperation between us without a trace of partisanship. Our acts must be guided by one single hard-headed thought: keeping America out of this war. In that spirit, I am asking the leaders of the two major parties in the Senate and the House of Representatives to remain in Washington between the close of this extraordinary session and the beginning of the regular session on January 3, 1940. They have assured me that they will do so, and I expect to consult with them at frequent intervals on the course of events in foreign affairs and on the need for future action in this field, whether it be executive or legislative action. And further, in the event of any future danger to the security of the United States, or in the event of need for any new legislation of importance, I will immediately reconvene the Congress in another extraordinary session. I should like to be able to offer the hope that the shadow over the world might swiftly pass. I cannot. The facts compel my stating with candor that darker periods may lie ahead. The disaster is not of our making. No act of ours engendered the forces which assault the foundations of civilization. And yet, we find ourselves affected to the core. Our currents of commerce are changing. Our minds are filled with new problems. Our position in world affairs has already been altered. In such circumstances, our policy must be to appreciate in the deepest sense the true American interest. Rightly considered, this interest is not selfish. Destiny first made us with our sister nations on this hemisphere, joint heirs of European culture. Fate seems now to compel us to assume the task of helping to maintain in the Western world a citadel wherein that civilization may be kept alive. The peace, the integrity, and the safety of the Americas, these must be kept firm and serene. In a period when it is sometimes said that free discussion is no longer compatible with national safety, may you, by your deeds, show the world that we of the United States are one people, of one mind, one spirit, one clear resolution, walking before God in the light of the living.
And thus the President of the United States concludes his address, reviewing the neutrality laws of the country before a joint meeting of the newly convened special session of Congress in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. In just a few minutes, the joint session of the Congress will be adjourned, and the respective houses are expected to convene again on Monday. The applause for the President continues as he slowly turns from the Speaker's platform to go out of the door and out of the Capitol building. We expect to be back here at the Capitol shortly for some important news. This is John Charles Daly speaking from the House of Representatives in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. We return you now to our New York studios.
While the President of the United States was addressing both houses of Congress, Premier Daladier began a message to the people of France. Later, our translator, who has been listening to the speech over shortwave radio, will give you a free resume of the entire message. In the meantime, we will listen to Premier Daladier's concluding remarks. We take you now to Paris.
Bretagne ou en Alsace, elle ne renouvelle pas ses méthodes. Elle cherche partout des cinq in quart pour trahir leur patrie. Elle espère trouver des achats pour en scier la déchéance et en consacrer la servitude. Mais la France tout entière s'est dressée. Il n'y a pas chez nous de traîtres, mais un peuple unanime, courageux, résolu, qui inscrit sur ses drapeaux la liberté ou la mort. Après tant de mensonges et tant de reniements, la propagande allemande n'a plus maintenant qu'un dernier espoir. Celui de dissocier les forces qui vont briser sa marche vers la domination du monde. Il est clair que la propagande allemande n'a plus maintenant que deux objets. Elle veut séparer la France de l'Angleterre. Elle veut désunir les Français entre eux. Mais quand les Français entendent les ondes ennemies leur dire que cette guerre est la guerre de l'Angleterre, ils répondent non, c'est la guerre d'Hitler. Comment faire croire à des Français qui depuis des mois sentent grandir le péril sur leurs propres frontières qu'ils font la guerre pour la Grande-Bretagne? La propagande allemande a tort de ne pas changer de procédé quand elle déborde le territoire du Reich. Les Français connaissent par l'expérience, autant que par le sentiment, la valeur de l'amitié britannique. Ils voient la marine de l'Angleterre casser et détruire les sous-marins allemands. Ces avions combattre dans notre ciel. Ses fils, non plus volontaires, mais soldats par devoir, rejoindre les soldats de France aux frontières de notre patrie. Ils savent aussi qu'un même idéal de liberté et de dignité humaine fait battre le cœur de la France, de l'Angleterre et des centaines de millions d'hommes qui, dans leurs empires immenses, dévouent toute leur force à la cause commune. La radio hitlérienne peut reprendre ce thème à l'infini. Pas un Français ne peut en être dupe. Plus ridicule encore est l'espoir de dresser des Français contre leur patrie. Monsieur Goebbels, ou son successeur, peut faire entendre à sa radio des voix de femmes qui prétendent parler au nom des mères françaises. Ses employés de sa propagande peuvent lire leur appel, qui n'est qu'une offense à la douleur des mères véritables. Un Français déshonoré, traître à son pays, peut s'apitoyer dans les studios allemands sur le destin de nos soldats. Aucun d'entre vous ne peut être pris à des pièges aussi grossiers. Ce chantage aux sentiments les plus nobles ne fait que soulever votre dégoût et que raffermir votre volonté. Car la propagande allemande a pu mentir sur tout, mais il est une chose sur laquelle elle ne saurait vous tromper, vous abuser, c'est votre amour pour la France. L'amour de la France a renouvelé le miracle qui assura notre salut chaque fois que nous avons été en péril. Dans l'épreuve, notre communauté nationale devient de jour en jour plus ardente et plus fraternelle. Nous faisons la guerre parce que nous ne voulons pas que la France soit asservie. Pour son salut, nous mettrons en œuvre toutes nos forces. Nous continuerons à prendre toutes les mesures d'ordre intérieur, de discipline, d'économie, afin que le pays tout entier participe à l'effort commun. Nous ne permettrons pas que certains s'enrichissent pendant que d'autres donneraient leur sang. Nous sommes calmes et résolus. Nous ne sommes pas hantés, comme nos ennemis, par la crainte d'une guerre longue. Nous ne pensons qu'à une chose, à la victoire totale. Cette victoire, nous la considérerons comme acquise dès que nous pourrons créer, fonder la paix sur des bases solides. Dès que nous pourrons enfin apporter à la France la sécurité définitive que les entreprises hitlériennes lui ont retirée depuis 3 années. L'épreuve est dure. Les sacrifices seront douloureux. Mais la France a vaincu de plus grands périls. Nul n'a jamais pu la détruire. Et il vient toujours une heure où les forces morales qui font l'armature des grandes nations pacifiques leur donnent la victoire. Ces forces morales, elles animent toutes nos armées que le péril n'a pas prises au dépourvu. Elles ont les moyens qui permettent de résister et de vaincre. Elles ont le courage, elles ont la science, elles ont la foi. Elles combattent pour l'indépendance et la sécurité de notre patrie et pour en finir à tout jamais avec les entreprises de domination de l'Allemagne. La France n'a pas pris les armes pour incendier des villes, livrer à la mort des femmes et des enfants, torturer des hommes sans défense. Elle a pris les armes pour une cause juste et humaine, et c'est pour cela qu'elle aura la victoire.
Mesdames, Messieurs, vous venez d'entendre M. Édouard Daladier, président du Conseil des ministres.
From Paris, CBS has brought you the voice of Premier Daladier addressing a message to the people of France. In our studios in New York, translators have been copying the message in English, and now, in just a moment, we'll present a free resume of what Premier Daladier said. Are you ready, sir?
Monsieur Daladier, French Prime Minister, said that for 20 days France has been at war. I want to tell you, he said, of the military and diplomatic conditions of our fight. I want to tell you, soldiers of France, what your duty is. You are a nation of free men, and you must remain free men always. I have just visited the front and seen our positions on German territory. I have seen the value and the intelligence and skill of our high command, which avoids every temptation of sending its men forward recklessly and having them slaughtered. I have admired our soldiers. I have seen with emotion and am proud of our gallant soldiers who fight because Germany has tried to use force against us. And we want to be finished once and for all with this atmosphere of threat and force. We must fight this force that tries to crush France. The Hitler domination already exercises a reign of terror over Germany. German domination has also crushed Poland, but before Poland also Czechoslovakia and Austria. The efforts of all those who have tried for peace because the destruction of Poland was prepared in advance by the threat of force and secret treaties. Positions were gained. But now Poland not only has given herself up in martyrdom, but has shown heroism after her first defeats because her mobilization was not complete when the German mechanized divisions marched through her territory. Poland consolidated her resistance later along shortened lines, but the German motorized divisions were too strong. Russia also came into the fight through a secret pact. The division of Poland was decided upon by Russia and Germany. Hitler had the precious contract, that is, the contract with Russia, in his hands before he even attacked Poland. What man of honor could be content with Hitler's promises of today, since all his previous pledges he has torn up one by one? In 1934, Hitler said that Germany would respect the Locarno Pact, but in 1936, he occupied the Rhineland. Later, he told the world that Germany would never annex Austria. Then he did annex Austria. On the 26th of September, he said the Sudetens were the last problem to be resolved by Germany. But on the 29th of September, at Munich, he promised us, and me personally, that he would not annex the Czechoslovaks because he wanted only, he said, the purity of the German race. But on March 13th, Prague was occupied. Bohemia was reduced to servitude. Later, Hitler said that Germany considered Poland's frontiers were permanent and irrevocable. Now, after tearing up Poland, he says that he wants nothing more. He has promised not to touch France, but we know too well that he will do the same thing to us if he can. His ambition is to isolate France from all her friends. Germany is developing her propaganda everywhere. She wants to separate our provinces one from the other. But all of France has arisen like one man. There is no traitor among us. We want liberty or death. After so many lies, German propaganda has only now the further hope of separating her enemies and dominating the world. She wants to separate France from England and disunite France among herself. But to all this we reply, no. It is not our war, but Hitler's war. We are fighting for ourselves and for Great Britain. German propaganda is making a great mistake in not changing its tactics. The British fleet, Monsieur Daladier said, and her planes are fighting gallantly, and her soldiers are joining ours for liberty and human dignity. Our two immense empires, that is, the French and British empires, are united. We will not be Hitler's dupes. The German radio, he said, has been using all sorts of tactics, notably that of having women speak, trying to imitate French mothers in order to plead with their sons not to fight. But our soldiers, said Monsieur Daladier, cannot be caught in such a trap. Your dignity, he said, in speaking to the French soldiers, will be aroused. Germany cannot deceive your love for France. The love of France has consecrated our ardor all along the line, he said. We are threatened, and we are fighting not to be slaves. We will take every measure of discipline within our country, said Monsieur Daladier, in order to fight the good fight. We are calm and resolute and are not haunted by the fear of a long war. We want the final victory, and then we want to found a peace on a sound basis. The test will be hard, he warned the French soldiers. The sacrifices will be grievous. But France has always conquered every peril, he said, and with her moral strength has won every victory. The French army has courage, science, and faith, said Monsieur Daladier. We will finish this time once and for all with Germany's efforts of domination. We are fighting now for justice and humanity, and we will have victory.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was our translator in New York giving you a free resume of the message Premier Daladier delivered to the people of France. The message was begun while President Roosevelt in Washington was addressing both houses of Congress. Now, the latest news from Bucharest, Romania, where Premier Călinescu was shot and killed today. It is officially announced in Bucharest that members of the outlawed pro-Nazi Iron Guard killed the Romanian premier. The announcement called the attack cowardly. It said the assassins were arrested. And it said further that a new premier will be sworn in right away in advance of a meeting of the Crown Council with King Carol. Romanian officials said that order prevails throughout the country. The German news agency, meanwhile, says that the Nazis didn't do the deed. Reports received in Bucharest said that Romanian police at Cernoti, which is near the Polish frontier, had raided the German house there, and it was reported had found material outlining the attitude which German residents were to take in the event German troops were to arrive at the Polish-Romanian frontier, a border now manned on the Polish side, not by Germans, but by the troops of the Red Army of Soviet Russia, following the Russian occupation of eastern Poland. Bulletin, Paris. Germans today subjected French positions on the Western Front to the heaviest shelling of the war. Here are just a few more dispatches. Berlin, the Romanian legation says an army leader, General Ernst Balif, has been named to replace Premier Călinescu. This indicates a strongly militant government in this pivotal Balkan kingdom. Romanian officials say they will enforce a rigid policy of neutrality. Paris. Europe's western battlefront is quiet today, but it may be only the lull before the storm. Troops are on the march in both France and Germany, moving up to bulwark front lines. France has now completed general mobilization with 6 million men under arms, and British troop movements in France continue at a feverish pace. We repeat the bulletin which counteracts that remark that we were just giving you in that dispatch, that Germans today subjected French positions on the western front to the heaviest shelling of the war. A further broadcast on the European situation will be presented by CBS later in the day and evening. There will be a summary of developments as reported by the Press Association at 6 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, and H.P. Kaltenborn will analyze the day's happenings at 6:15. The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present the nightly broadcast of Elmer Davis and the News at 8:55 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.